Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thong, Earthlets, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, the official podcast of the galaxy's greatest comic. I am your host, as always, Malt Char. And on this episode, we're talking about the 2000 AD Sci-Fi Special, which is out now from Organ Newsagents and the 2000 AD Shop and App. This is a crossover event where Judge Dredd and lots of Dreadworld characters come together in one overarching narrative over several stories. And on this episode, we've got the Machiavellian plotters behind this this experiment, which is writers Michael Carroll and Maura McHugh, who should be no strangers to regular listeners of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. So we dive into a little bit about the project, how it came about, how they have worked to coordinate with the other creatives on board, and if you're able to get a copy, whether it's print or digital, then it's definitely worth your time. Really fascinating to see how all the different bits fit together. So great to hear from them. Thank you, as always, for the suggestions that have been coming in on the email, which is Thrillcast. That's all one word, thrillcast@2080.com. Still working on some of those suggestions for future interviews. In 7 days' time, we're going to be hearing another classic episode from the Thrillcast, which is, since Ben Wheatley's got a new film out, perhaps it's time to revisit him. So we go back to chat to him. It was around about the time of High Rise, his adaptation of the J.G. Ballard novel, that we had a chat with him about his love of 2000 AD. So that'll be in 7 days' time. In the meantime, if you're starved of thrill power, make sure you go along to shop.2000ad.com to check out the latest releases coming from 2000 AD. Also, if you go along to the website, 2008.com, there's actually further interviews with Mike and Maura, plus also the other people involved in the 2008 Sci-Fi Special, which includes David Bailey, James Newell, Anna Morozova. Great to hear from them and to dig down into what is actually a major undertaking to do, like a multi-character crossover set in the world of Dredd. So let's crack on and hear from Mike and Maura about the thinking and the process and the consequences, outcome of their work on the 2000 AD Sci-Fi Special. So let's talk the 2000 AD Sci-Fi Special, because it's been out for a week now. Yeah. And I want to get you both on because this is something a little bit different. It's a crossover. Now, 2000 AD has occasionally dipped its toe in the crossover waters. So, you know, various characters have made sure that Dredd has met Kurth Coburn and Armitage and Devlin War separately. But this is really bringing them together in an overarching narrative. I wanted to start off by asking how this came about, whether this was something that Tharg approached you both to do, or this was it something that had been percolating away for a little while?
Well, yeah, Matt Tharg, the mighty Tharg, approached us. And though Mike and I had started talking during the first lockdown about doing something together, just privately. And I think at some point I might have mentioned that to Matt in an email, just that we were discussing things. And I don't know if that sort of lodged in the back of his head. But yeah, he came to us. And it was a case of you know, you just have to do something like this when you're offered it. Yeah,
it was too good an opportunity to turn down. I mean, obviously as a freelancer, if the editor says, "Can you?" the answer is always yes. And then you go, "Can we?" Yes, you can. Yes. But in this case, because Maura and I are both really familiar with Dredd and the Dredd world in general, but from kind of from different angles, it was a great chance to sort of have a meeting of our two minds and the ways in which we want to see Dredd going forward. Also, one thing that was particularly of interest to me, and I think tomorrow, was that we in 2008 we've never had this the idea of all the creators get, or writers in particular, getting together, have a big meeting to steer the future, or at least to have some ideas of where the future might be going. So we've never had that, and this was a way to do that on a smaller scale, maybe a test level. Mm-hmm. And I think it worked pretty well. More than I had, as you said, we've been bouncing ideas back and forth for quite some time. So we didn't necessarily use any of those ideas, but this gave us a good chance to see how well the collaboration works.
Mike and I we've been talking for quite a while about the thing. Wouldn't it be great if the 2008 writers could have some giant meeting once a year? I believe they do this in some of the big the other comic studios who shall not be named.
The non-independent ones, yes.
Yeah. I believe they do that on some of the big characters, you know. And so the chance to work with other 2008 writers was fantastic. And then, you know, I personally would have loved to have the same interaction with the artists, but it's actually quite a complicated situation to put all of this together. And like Mike and I got such a small insight into how difficult Matt's job is, and that's only for one special, you know. But it would be great, I think, to have more communication going on between the writers. Although, you know, maybe some people just don't want to, you know, to be fair, they may not want to hear anything about what anyone else is doing. But in this case, it made perfect sense. It was great. And we really ran with the ball once Matt handed it to us. And now he did say the different characters that he wanted to work with. And it was his idea to put Devlin and Armitage together. Brilliant, because I'm a big fan of grumpy couples, you know, the odd couple kind of scenario. And I think Liam did such a terrific job in that dynamic, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, so and then with Chopper as well in Inaba, he asked us, these were the characters he wanted to work with, and Dredd and Anderson, obviously. So, yeah.
Yeah, the basic idea came from Matt. He said he wanted something on a more, oh, I don't want to spoil it too much, but a global threat, if you like, to some degree. And we could have gone down the road of having aliens or I don't know, ancient Mesopotamians who invented time travel and they want to conquer the future. Damn, that's good, actually. We're doing that one next. But we came up with what we came up with basically was a more credible threat. It also has some resonance to what's happening in the world today. But it was interesting, much as we were going on with it, we were sort of realizing we're not giving a lot of space to the other characters. This is what I was thinking, because we sort of divided up into Dredd has to have a big chunk at the beginning because everybody expects Dredd, and he got a 10-page chunk, and then the other characters got 6-page chunks, and then Anderson, which Maura wrote, got another 10-page chunk, and we wrapped it up with 10 pages at the end. And we thought, yeah, we're really hogging the blankets here with this one. But then it's our bit. So it was, I really got a buzz to see a lot more of the supporting characters. I want to see what happens. What has Inaba been up to for the past 10 years? Yeah. Where is she going from here? People who are new enough to 2008 might not, or to Dredd's world, might not really realize who she is and what her history is and how she started. But, I mean, there's the character that we really have to see. How did she cover the 10 years or so? I think it was 10 years since she last appeared. Because Dredd stories still age in real time. Mm-hmm. So if the character hasn't been in the comic for a number of years, then that time is she's not sitting there idly by twiddling her thumbs, and nor is she skipping ahead. It's not like the old Spider-Man thing where he's always been Spider-Man for about 5 years now, that kind of thing. It's because, was it 44 years now since it was 2099 in Mega City 1? Well, that makes, I'm going to do my mental maths here, that makes it the year 2043 or thereabouts. Actually, I'm cheating because I have that written down on a little notepad because I never remember. But so when we look at someone like Armitage, he started in 1990, and he was already an old guy. He was at least my age now. So now that's, I'm 55. So, I mean, that's like makes him at least 85. You know, so we've got to see, you know, what's he able to do from now on. Devlin Moyle, of course, cheats by being a vampire and therefore not aging. But yeah, so it's tremendously good fun to do this, to have the little window into their lives. And hopefully we get to see them again, because the writers and the artists have done amazing work on this. And
I mean, I really loved what David Bailey did with Chopper. And then Tom Foster was just so fantastic. I mean, David's script came in and Mike and I were like, oh yes, this is the kind of script we want to see come in the door. And so it's really nice when you get that. And then Tom really did the business. I was so happy. And the coloring and the lettering. I mean, it's all a whole, you know, it's a whole team effort indeed. Though, I mean, Tom's put up a couple of processes, if anyone was interested, on his Twitter. So you can see a couple of panels where you can see his going from pencils to inks. And it's like really, I love looking at stuff like that. I think it's really great. But, and I think Chopper is a great character. He's not one I was super familiar with, or in ABBA, in fact. I had to do some research on both of them. But I just loved what he did with them, and the hair and the, you know, it's just, well, that was Tom, but it was written that way, let's say. but yeah, I just thought there's a real sort of joyfulness to Chopper. And I think sometimes with Dread, you just, you know, with the 2018 universe, you really do need these like injections of fun. And, you know, because sometimes the future can be fun.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And it's a great contrast as well. If the future is always dystopic and it's always dour, it can be heart-rending. But when you see someone like Chopper who's facing horrible situations, but he's still enjoying life to some degree, that's great. Actually, the same with Devlin Moyle as well, because Devlin Moyle won't let anything get him down, because he kind of traipses along having a great time and knowing that nothing can hurt him, which is pretty cool. So yeah, I'd say the other creators have done an amazing job, especially I have to tip the hat to Carl Sock and to David, because Liam, because they're new relatively to 2000 AD, comparatively anyway. I mean, obviously David Bailey's been working on 2000 AD for yonks, and he did the brilliant Wandering Soul Chopper story, which kind of, this one's kind of a sequel to, which I loved. But yeah, I like that when we had our big meeting, hopefully it was just myself and Maura dictating the way things should be to the other writers. I think we took their input on board, or I think we gave the very good impression of taking their input on board, which is just as important, you know.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks. How did you go about framing this and forming this idea in a way that things would move in the direction that you wanted, but you were also giving enough latitude to writers like Liam and David and Carl, so that they could do their own thing without being too prescriptive? How did you start that process?
Yeah, well, Mike and I had, we had so many discussions about this. And I mean, as I said, thank Targ for high-speed broadband. No, honestly. And it certainly saved me during lockdown. And this happened during the third lockdown in Ireland. So I was delighted to have this regular kind of chatting with Mike. I think it actually really helped me save my mind during that period. But yeah, so we sat down, we rang on, sort of rang doesn't even use the correct term. We called each other and we figured out the narrative. Then we, I think Mike probably, because he's very like that, you know, hammered out a first draft of the narrative. Yep. And then I would go in and tidy it up and not, you know what I mean, Mike? I'm not saying
made it good, yes. Put the bad bits out.
First drafts are always, you know, that's actually quite the hard work. So Then after that, what we did is we had an outline of each of the three stories of them. Like really, I'm talking very rough, nothing terrible, what we thought would work within the bigger narrative. So then what we did is, the other thing is we believed in real transparency for the writers. So we had a shared drive, and we shared everything so that they saw all the process, see what was coming in. And similarly with all the scripts and all the art, they got to see everything. So it wasn't like we were just like holding a barrier between them. Yeah. So what happened then is with the meeting, it was great because they had read the outline before the meeting. And then in this big meetup we had, we just had a great fun because we just were knocking ideas around and they were very excited. Yeah. I don't think I'm making that up now about to be involved in the project. And then we let them do it because they had to write the scripts, not us.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to speak for the other writers, but they all thought I was awesome. So we had a black box approach to some degree. Now, this was the original idea, was that we'd say, okay, this is kind of what we want to happen around your story. We want you to write about, say, an ABBA or Armitage or whatever. And we'll let you do your own thing and then we'll come back and pick up the pieces at the end. But as it was, we definitely get a bit more hands-on with all the stories, saying, you know, hang on, we need to steer it here and it needs to go there. And we went back for rewrites and I'm sure that they hated us by the end of it. But we weren't doing it for our own egos. We were basically, it was all to do with the good of the story. The story had to be the key thing. And if we were doing it again, I don't know. I think maybe a better approach might be, this was purely with hindsight, is to have them involved in the overall story design from the beginning. But as it was, we weren't thinking of those terms to start with. Also, when we initially started, we didn't know who the other writers would be. So we were kind of firing blind there. But yeah, I think it works really well. Because all the other writers are very experienced in their fields, if it's not just comics. Liam is tremendous experience elsewhere, and as does Carl. So they knew how to write, but they weren't quite as familiar with writing comics, whereas Dave Bailey was. So we had a lot of range of experience there. And
We also had a bit of a time crunch because we didn't get this. We kind of got this project a little late, considering all the spinning plates involved. Yes. So we got into that narrative fast. Like we created that, the overall within a week, I think, of calls and writing it. And then, so the other thing that Mike is saying there is that we kind of wrote the scripts came in sequentially. So, and we designed it that way, partly so that we might need to pick up things from the other people's scripts. So, so it was a bit of an exquisite corpse going on, sort of. Once we knew the other writers had the meeting, Mike straight away wrote the first script. And then we asked the other writers to have them in at certain times. Now I was I was writing the Anderson script after all the three writers. So I'd seen all their scripts and we had actually gone through edits with them as well. So and I wrote mine and then Mike and I co-wrote the last one. So there was actually a call and response going on throughout the process. So it wasn't just like so we were reacting somewhat to all that was going on in the previous scripts. And that's very enjoyable as a writer. I personally just enjoy that.
Yeah, me too. It was weird because I'm so used to being solitary. I just write my ideas, fire them off, whether it's novels or whatever. And because everything I do is perfect from the get-go, I never get any feedback. So that's not entirely true, to be honest. But it definitely feels like this is something I would love to do again. On a different scale, though, I would like to do it on a larger scale. To some degree, I've kind of done this with the Judges novellas, just bringing that in for no reason, the fact that they're behind me there on the shelves. where we're kind of come up with a vague, vague sounds wrong. We come up with it with a slender outline and say we kind of want the book to be about this and then let the writer do their own thing. And we just make sure that they're not going too far off the beaten track, or indeed, the severely beaten track. So we just make sure that, you know, if someone doesn't invent something that wouldn't have shown up in later Meg City 1 history. But in this case, we were definitely more hands-on. It'd be very interesting to do it on a different scale where the Mighty Targ gave us complete freedom to pick the writers and the artists, because actually, that would be a bad idea, because I would just pick me to do all the writing. And I don't trust myself, but it would be interesting. But when we realize what we went through to get this thing off the ground, and Matt has to do it 60 times a year, at least. How many of them are there? Can't be just one Matt Smith out there. There's lots, isn't there?
Yeah, he's cloned himself, I think.
Oh, the reason why that scene got cut from the Stallone film, you know, all the clones, it was a little bit too close to home, because that's what the basement looks like at work.
That makes sense.
Lots of clones of Matt. You know, when we wear out one, we crack out the other one. You know.
At last, a plot thinnens.
Well, I mean, it is an interesting point about the art of editing. Is itself, I personally think it's vastly underrated in comics, you know, particularly as the kind of notion of the auteur has really taken over the discourse around comics, you know, the creators are the ones whose work it is. But a good editor is worth their weight in gold, if not more.
Absolutely.
If not for just, you know, providing an extra pair of eyes, a guiding hand, but also just putting the damn thing together, you know, it is sometimes miraculous to watch the prog, to watch the Meg come together. So I guess this was just a taste of, as you say, what happens 60 odd times a year. In the office, but I'm interested in the experiences that you drew on for something like this. You know, you're both writers. You've both worked in this world already in different ways. Were there particular experiences or skills that you found yourself drawing on that were unexpected in putting this together?
You're from Your turn.
I don't think so, but I would say that I do have experience editing, and Mike has got a tremendous amount as well. And Mike, the great thing is, if you have any questions about the 2000 AD universe, Mike generally knows the answer to them.
Sometimes I just lie, you know.
But no, I mean, I there wasn't anything. It was, I've done a lot of organization of things, of events and stuff like that. So I think when you approach a project like this, it's like project management. It's just that simple. So if you're not organized, like one of the things Mike and I did was create a spreadsheet, you know, and you know, this kind of really boring stuff that people don't realize, you know, and this was, our spreadsheet was small. I mean, Matt's must have been much, much bigger, because we were only wrangling the writers, and Matt was dealing with the artists and the colorists and the letterers, and then he has to put the whole thing to bed on top of it. So like, we were only project managing one end of the thing. But and I should stress, of course, that Matt did have an editorial eye on all the scripts. It wasn't like he just went, oh yes, whatever, you know. And we always appreciate that. Matt's got a great insight into stories, and I have depended upon that loads of times. So I think the drawing upon the project management part of things I have done in the past, but that doesn't even seem like anything new to me, you see, Mike, because that's like, it's like breathing. It's like, I do it all the time. So it doesn't even seem like when I get a project like this, my automatic attitude is to line it up and figure out when you're working with other people is to be very clear in communication, very responsive, and also to stress deadlines in this case, because again, we actually were a bit tight and all the writers made their deadlines.
Oh yeah. Yeah, they did. Well, Mamor and I both run conventions and things like that, and work with committees. And the first thing back in my old life, I was a project manager on various things I worked on. And I've always had the mantra that, make the other people clear. Don't tell me you weren't able to do something. Tell me you won't be able to do something. You don't want to keep someone in the dark, hope everything's going to work out okay, because the work has to be done. And ultimately, even if, for example, Maura and I had fallen out, or we'd fallen out with one of the others, I know which one as well. God, he was tough. But if this had happened, it would have been bad. But the key thing is still to get the product out on time, because in a year's time, people won't remember the struggle that they had getting wrangling a writer or an artist or getting the right sort of work out of them. The only thing that's left at the end is the finished product, which Maura has there. She can hold up and show you. I haven't got one because they haven't sent me one yet.
Yeah, arrived in the post to Ireland today, lovely. West of Ireland today. So I'm excited to have mine anyway.
Yeah. But it's like with a movie where Matt would be the director and producer, and we were like second assistant directors. With a big badge that says, I'm a second assistant director, ask me how. but we are effectively wrangling the talent too, but it's not really our show. But what the important thing is ultimately that it is the product at the end. That's the whole point. So it's not about egos. It's not about, someone accused me online of, this was me attempting to take over the Dread universe. I'm going, what? No.
You don't want to pay attention to what anybody says online, Michael. You should know.
No, I've learned that. Yeah, apparently. Actually, there's that thing on the internet where it says check lies. It turns out to be off all the time by default. But it is. Ultimately, it's the key thing. We want people to look back and go, yeah, that was fun. We don't need them to see the struggles and the trials and the pain involved. Or anything like that. It's not about the writers or the creators. It's about the story.
Yeah. So we were like, that was our main thing as well, is that we wanted everything to be as good as possible, because we knew this was an unusual event for 2000 AD. Yeah. And so I probably worked harder on this than I have worked on anything in, not that I was, it was just... It was important to me, not that I give lesser attention to other projects. I have to be careful here now. But it just meant a lot to us that we were asked to do this. And it meant, so we did try our best to do as good a job as possible. And I mean, even editing, like I was editing Mike's work, he was editing mine. You know, we weren't immune from critique. And it was actually really great to have that input, even if you might occasionally go, you read the occasional comment, but usually, Mike's right. So
I
got to edit Mike, so that was good.
yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, and I got to write Dread, which is great.
You did get to write Dread. Yes, and I got to write Anderson.
Anderson, yeah.
I don't think I've ever done before. Even, I've written hundreds of episodes of Dread at this stage, and I don't think I've ever had Judge Anderson in there. A couple of times I wanted to include her, and I was told, no, she's off limits at the moment, or she was busy, or something like that, or she won't work with me, she has an ego. But, it was good fun. I would definitely, I'd love to do this again on a different level. I'd love it if Matt would say, hey guys, do the winter special, and it doesn't have to be a linked story, it can be just random stories, and that would be easier, and that would be good fun.
Yeah. But, Yeah, we were talking about like where we would weave a narrative based on other people's stories. So in that way, we would be responding and we would put an element of it, the overall story, inside each of the contributors. That's one of the things we were chatting about. Yeah. And that would be much more an Exquisite Corpse, where we are responding to the work and not, you know, establishing. Mike's looking, yes, we did talk about it.
I'm just wondering how long I can get away with not knowing what you mean by Exquisite Corpse.
Oh, sorry. You know, where someone said, oh, sorry, I should have stressed it. Okay. You know, where someone says a story and then the next person writes a story in response to the first story.
Oh, we used to call that round robin thing.
The same thing.
Well, excuse me, Miss Posh, I've been to
my apologies.
Proper writer's
Round, you know, it's where you're working in response to other work. You've no set agenda. It's actually very freeing sometimes, and it can be a bit scary as well, but the thing is, you're always trying to challenge yourself as well. I am always trying to challenge myself as a writer. It was great.
That's actually one of the great things is it is a challenge to work with, when you're not used to working with someone else, to work with them and to say to yourself, no, hang on a minute, maybe their ideas are better, you know, I mean, and because it is a very ego-driven thing in a way to say, you know, my words will go into other people's minds and therefore my words are the best words. But that's not necessarily true. Sometimes other people, you know, will come up with brilliant ideas. Well, I've learned that from working on the George's novellas and from working with the writers in general, where I realized, you know, hang on, maybe I'm not the best writer in the world. And, you know, but that doesn't last long. Usually I go back to, yes, of course I am. But it's fascinating to stand on their shoulders, as it were.
Yeah.
So the guys come up with this, I think, God, I wouldn't have gone down that road. I go, no, actually, no, kind of wish I had thought of that, because, you know, these are great writers and great minds. And I definitely think that for the two newbies who are basically Carl and Liam, they're going to go a long way. You know, I mean, hopefully they go in the right direction, but they will go a long way. You know, and as long as they look back and remember where it all began. You
know? I mean, on this special, you've got two alumni of the Thought Bubble Talent Contest. You know, Liam won the script competition, and James Newell, who draws the final episode, won the art competition the other year. There aren't many opportunities for new talent to come through. You know, the number of Future Shocks that we publish a year by sheer necessity has gone down. So with something like this, it's nice to see, you know, people that we've actually gone, yeah, actually you're good enough. Why not give it a whirl? So I'm guessing from what you've just said that there wasn't any kind of need for mentorship or sort of holding hands?
There was a bit. Yeah, but I think, I don't want to single out any particular story, but there was one story that where we went through more iterations than I would have expected. But in that particular case, the writer was brilliant, but just untamed. And we don't necessarily want tamed writers, but we want them at least to be heritable or steered. You know, you've basically fired your energy in this particular direction, and for now, because we need to come out at the end of the story in a particular fashion. If it had been a totally free-for-all and we didn't have to have an overall story arc, I would have been happy enough to let the writers go where they wanted to go. But we needed to go, yeah, look, this is brilliant, but it's the wrong kind of brilliant today. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so he's dead now. No, he's not.
I mean, this was going to be one of my questions, is that when you have an overarching narrative, you have a plan that you need to fit into, and you've already mentioned the time constraints that you had, can there sometimes be, can that breed a lack of spontaneity and you know, a need to tack as close as possible to the plan?
Yeah. I'd say, there's a danger that we can become too constrained by the the limitations, I would say, for example, that myself and Maura put on the story, that the other writers were constrained. But I've always believed as a writer that you can only scale to new heights by climbing obstacles. If you have a totally free playing field, you're not necessarily going to go anywhere. You've got to have, you've got to have a challenge so that you can grow. And hopefully, this sounds like a really weak excuse in some ways, but by making things harder for the other writers, we made them better. And I'm so sorry, because they were already brilliant to begin with. Maybe we didn't make them better. Maybe we hamstrung them. But I don't know. I mean, Maura, you've got much more experience working with proper writers than I do. How do you feel?
Oh, would you stop? No, but I don't think we really constrained them at all. We just said, this is the rough outline. We had a great conversation. They wrote what they wanted to then, and then came back to us. And on a couple of them, we just had to steer them, in the right, just for the sake of narrative, but it wasn't onerous, and it wasn't that terrible. The thing that Mike is saying is absolutely the case, is that if you have a blank canvas, that's much harder. I actually find it, in some ways, limitations are actually much easier to work within, because your mind bounces off the limitation, and often you might try to sneakily get around it just to be sly, but it causes you to be inventive. So, someone, funny enough, when you were talking, Mike, I was thinking that somebody had recently just told me a story about someone they had worked with in comics who had was supposed to be writing a graphic novel, and he checked in with them recently, and it was 4 years later, and he still hadn't it done. And this is someone who has the blank canvas and has no deadline and has no urgency, and has, so everything else is going to get in your way of doing the project, and you'll invent every excuse in the world. Deadlines can be awful, but with 2000 AD, they're not mutable. We may have leeway in other projects we work on, but with comics and production, you don't. Like, you have to get them in on time. Mm-hmm. And we were quite upfront about that. And we weren't evil. We weren't anything. We just said, look, and in fact, I think we got our scripts in a week ahead of time. I think all the scripts were done.
Oh yeah, we were early. Yeah, we did do that trick of lying to the other writers about how much time they had, but they don't know that until now. but absolutely, the key thing is that if you want to be seen as a professional, deliver on time. I mean, I know that people like Douglas Adams and Alan Moore or whoever are notorious for late scripts, or whatever, maybe not Alan, but some people they admire their writer for heroes who never deliver on time. And they go, yeah, really? Yeah, I'm not sure that's their good thing in the end, Mm-hmm. Deliver your work on time, or tell them why you won't deliver on time. Don't just sit there and hope the deadline will, whiz by unnoticed. So, I certainly learned a lot from this process about storytelling, because having to read other people's scripts and analyze what works in those scripts and what I need to do to keep them working while making them work with the overall story. That was something I've never really done to this level, not for a very long time. Mm. It was good. Yeah, I would definitely do it again for more money if the opportunity came up. Yeah.
Yeah.
We did not make a fortune out of this,
No.
We're driving the old Porsche out there,
Yeah. I mean, it was an awful lot of extra work.
I think we did too much more. I think we were too kind,
But I think that's just because we wanted it to be the best project it could be. And it was really nice to see the art coming in. To be partisan, I was really, really happy with Anna's artwork on the Anderson story. We had not really a lot to say about the artist. Matt has his magical spreadsheet that he works off. But I had mentioned her and I'd said, I really like her work. And then Mike said, we were like, wouldn't she be great to put into the project? And Also, she was very excited and passionate about doing it. And she had not done an Anderson, like one of the big characters before. So it's really nice when you work with someone who, and I was lucky because I knew her very tiny amount. So we were able to connect. And I love doing that, being able to talk to the artist and to give them an open door and say, here, you may please come talk to me. And so she was like showing me pencils and stuff. We didn't get that with every artist. In my case, I was lucky with Anna and because I had that connection. I love it. And usually all I'm saying is, fantastic. You know, it's very rare. If I work with an artist and I spot something small, I usually say, well, I think that detail is slightly wrong. But generally, I'm there to just clap enthusiastically. And Anna was just, she was just enthusiastic, passionate, loved the characters, and I loved her style. So yeah, I was lucky in that regard.
Oh yeah, we were very lucky with the artists. They were all brilliant, but I got a real buzz when I found out that Robin Smith was going to be drawing the Armitage and Devon Waugh story, because obviously I'm a fan from 2008, from the very, very, very beginning, and I've never had a chance to work with Robin before. I was like, oh yes, yes, that's one off the must work with list, you know?
Yeah. So
that was a real buzz. And
Neil Gouge's in ABBA is,
yeah, like, it's a pretty
brilliant
amazing
stuff.
Yeah. Like, I have to say they did a great job. We have to I would have liked to have had a little bit more time so we could define some of the character designs with characters who carry over across the different stories to shape them a little bit closer to our visions. But again, you know, there was deadlines, we were up against it, and you know, it was a learning experience for us, I think, as much as anybody else. But
Matt seemed to be happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we live in
very important
of getting on his bad side, obviously. So you know, because we know what he's like when he gets wild up and the knives come out. But it was. I don't think Matt regretted us. At least he hasn't let on that he's regretted picking us yet.
Is that the kind of proof of the pudding? So long as there are no regrets.
he's still talking to me. I don't know about you, Maura, but...
I'm doing an Anderson, so I guess I'm okay.
I'm actually doing another Dread 2-parter, so with Matt, just actually in the middle of an email at the moment. So I think he's forgiven us for any mistakes we might have made along the way.
Let's talk a little bit about the characters, because like I said at the beginning, 2008 has dabbled in crossovers in the past with varying degrees of success. You know, you go from everything from the brief appearance of Dredd in Low Life, in the early Low Life stuff, through to the... what was it, Prog 1000, when it was a full prog story with Rogue Trooper and Dredd and all something other.
Yeah, it was one of those ones, yeah.
When you're dealing with characters with so much history within the context of where you're telling your story, does that create a challenge? Is that difficult to juggle when you know, particularly for example, Devlin Waugh and Armitage, two characters with very particular personalities, very particular backstories. And although there is some crossover in the kind of stories that have been told about them, you'd think they almost operated in separate worlds. So, you know, was it a challenge to have all this knowledge and backstory to these characters and then bring them together in a way that felt, and I hesitate to use this word, organic?
Yeah, it was. It was a challenge, you know, in a sense. And with Armitage and Wall in particular, I went back. I didn't really go back and reread everything. We went back and read an awful lot to see how often their paths have crossed. And I was able to count the number of times their paths crossed on the fingers of one foot. It was not great. And I thought, but they're operating in circles. So I figured that for most of the stories, they're actually just standing back to back and they can't see each other. I like to think that they were aware of each other, but they just hadn't met. But then when we wrote this, we come to the outline. It sort of, I decided, well, let's just assume that they know each other, Because why wouldn't they? I mean, Britsit is not huge. I mean, I know that Devon travels a lot and he wouldn't necessarily always be in Britsit, but it's not huge compared to Mega City 1. So let's decide that they know each other. Plus, of course, as we mentioned earlier, time passes in real time. Armitage hasn't shown up for a decade, apart from a brief appearance in the Lion's Den back in 2016. And that was 5 years ago. So we thought, well, surely he wasn't just, you know, sitting around waiting for the phone call to ring and someone to say, hey, you've got an adventure. So yeah, that paths cross. So it was easy enough. And actually, what was really impressive there, when Liam Johnson's first script came in for the Armitage and Wall story, it was like he'd been writing the characters for years.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of the onus of that story actually sits on Liam's shoulders, because the knack to write good dialogue between two quite different characters have it. But I do think there are that perfect odd couple match where they bounce off each other because of the nature of their characters. But yeah, it is a challenge to do that. But you know they've at least heard of each other if they have not met each other. Yeah. And you as the writer go into this with that idea in your mind. And Liam just, like, to be honest, Liam did a fantastic job in their interactions. And we were really happy with, because that was actually, of all of them, probably maybe it could have been the trickiest, yeah. But actually Liam's work came in so strong in the first draft that after that, we're only talking about, rough edges and tying things in. And yeah. And then with the other characters, yeah, one of the other big challenges is you want a special to kind of make sense on its own. And there is the problem with 2000 AD is this giant legacy it carries with us. I think a lot of people are intimidated by that to jump in, which is, of course, why 2000 AD has these jumping in issues a lot of the time. So, having characters talk about things that the reader wouldn't necessarily get completely. You have to be careful about that. That's a line you're constantly walking on 2000 AD, because you know some of the fans are going to understand what you're talking about, the people who've been with it a long time, but you don't want to make it so obtuse that someone's reading it going, what the hell is this? At least you want to make it intriguing enough that they will go, oh, I need to read more of this. And then they go and buy more 2000 AD, which is ultimately what you want.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yes. You really want readers the new readers to feel that there's a way in, because I've found myself with American comics, certain characters, I'm just going, I'd love to get into such and such, but I'm not going to go back and read 28 years worth of stories or whatever. So yeah, but with these specials, I think we did a good job. I think the trickiest one from that point of view was Inaba, because she has her own history. The story has to allude to it. And it's not easy to kind of to jump into this completely new culture. So anybody coming in totally new, hopefully will see, okay, this is obviously, it's in Japan or the future equivalent of Japan. It's got versions of judges over there. But it's got its own kind of flavor to the story. The judges are a bit more hardline in some respects. And we don't have, we were careful not to do cheapo tricks of having the characters talk about honor and samurais and stuff like that all the time, because it's very easy to slip into the shortcuts that are basically racist stereotypes. So that's it. We did have Armitage going to the pub. Hang on a second.
Well, then there's actual facts.
Yes. But I think so. That was a tricky one. But I would love now to go to see if maybe that story, Inaba in particular, could open the way for a series or something like that, to saying, you know, to see where she goes from there. How did she get to where she is, actually?
And we were constrained with page count. We were told the page count. And, so I would actually have loved to have more pages for each of the individual other artists, but writers and artists, but we literally didn't have the space.
We could have given up some of our pages so that they could have more pages. But you said, no, Mike, we're not doing that. And then you used all those horrible words. I don't even know what they mean.
You see, he's such a storyteller.
But yeah, it was there is a tradition of either 10 or 6-page stories.
Yeah.
And that was a restriction that we didn't have to stick to when you think about it. We could have gone beyond that. We could have said, no, we'll do 9 and 7-page stories.
Yeah, that doesn't work, you know yourself, with the math.
Well, it kind of doesn't work, actually, because stories should start on the right-hand page.
Yes, exactly.
No, then the reveal at the very end is on the left-hand page, and that way you don't see it when, you know, yeah. So that's how it has to be an even number of pages.
Secrets of the trade here. I just want to come back to the start of the project. And when you were conceiving of the idea of this crossover, and you know, before you knew who was going to be working on it, and before you'd been through that whole process, has the final product delivered on in the way that you hoped it would, that you expected it would, or has it in the making become something different?
I it's actually very close to what we originally envisioned, but better, because the individual writers did terrific jobs. And you know, we didn't have that in our mind. We only had outlines of that in our mind, and then the writers came in and we refined a little bit with them. But to be honest, they put in they put in all the work, and you know, so that's what you always hope. And then with the art coming in, you're always hoping that the art will be even better than you imagined, you know? So, I would say this has been really, it's always a magical process to write a comic, in my opinion, because you have an outline which you are trying to give something very ineffable across to your artists, you know? And then when they do the goods, you know, well, hopefully, but in this case they did, it's just, for me, it's an uplift. Like there is nothing that gives me more of a thrill than seeing art coming in of a script I wrote. It's like things conjured into real life that started in my head, or in our case, our heads, you know? And in fact, the other thing Mike and I talked about this is that I couldn't have written this comic this way on my own. Mike couldn't have written this comic, you know, that way on his own. The alchemy of working with other people makes everything better. And it's actually one of the brilliant things about collaboration. If you're with the right team and everyone's working at the high level, then it elevates the project constantly. So that's what I hope for. And in this case, we were very lucky. The other thing we got was a very magical little key Matt gave us, which is called a lettering pass, which we almost never get. And we were very pleased because we were able to tweak a couple of things based on the artwork and just to clarify here and there. And actually, in one case, remove quite a bit of dialogue. We were like, oh, no, this is just too much. Hey, what can we pull out at the last minute? And we didn't get much time on that. We had a very tight deadline on the lettering pass, which is fine. We were just very happy to get it.
Yeah, that was everything. It made us feel like we have more control than we would have otherwise. Because, yeah, I always think of comic writing as I'm writing the story for the artist and the colorist and the letterer. Their job is to present the story to the rest of the world. So if I mess up, they can fix it, or the editor will fix it. But we don't really... Yeah, it's kind of like we get a chance to push to get the ball rolling, but we don't get a chance to build the final snowman. This is talking about snowballs in this case, or, you know, any other kind of ball that grows like that. But we don't, we set it going, and then we come back at the end and go, oh, here's the finished comic. It's very nice to be able to go in and go, no, hang on, we can tweak this and just that. And there was a couple of cases where we, I think this the comic is a lot stronger because we were able to make a couple of tiny tweaks. One place we definitely tweaked the art, where we realized, oh, hang on a minute, this doesn't make sense because, and then there was another case where the artist had, I'm going to say, to be political, drew what he wanted to draw and not what he was told to draw. Or she, because I don't want people to know it was a him. And it was great. And the dialogue then didn't match because, I won't go into the details, but the dialogue didn't match. But at first glance, it seemed fine. And I was reading it going, wait, this doesn't, I see what's happened. He's not done this. So we were able to tweak the dialogue then to make that all fit. And I defy anybody who isn't me or Maura or the editors or the artists to actually spot what that was.
Because, well, they can't.
Yeah. And also, I can't remember. But so that was a case. We've never got that before. And I have occasionally with comics over the years had a case where the final product comes back and I go, oh, yeah, well, I wish someone had spotted this in the editing stage now because this bit is wrong or that bit could have been better. So it was good. I definitely would love to do that again. But we usually just don't have the time. Sometimes with Dread in particular, there's a very, very fast turnaround. Sometimes
I'm sure Matt does not want to give for the prog writers a lettering pass. Like, literally, can you just imagine trying to keep getting it back and then communicate it to the letterer? And the letterer doesn't often, like, and I mean, I have to be very clear about this, is that I highly, highly respect letterers, and I don't believe in making their job more difficult for them. So we were very judicious in that. We didn't want to make things difficult. We were just trying to. Usually, one of the things I like to do is, if I do get a pass, and I have on previous comics, just in 2000 AD, the logistics just make it extremely difficult. I have actually changed. I remember a comic where I changed. I actually removed the dialogue in a page on a panel because the artist had gotten the expression of the character so good. I was like, okay, I don't actually need any dialogue here. And I said, please pull that off that page, that panel completely. And that's actually something I really like to do. But if I can reduce dialogue, I always try to do that. But I try to do that on the script stage. That's like usually my last pass, is like, how much can I take off? Because balloons cover up art. And that's what you're trying to give space for.
Yeah, and brevity is there. I think it's very important to highlight. But yeah, when it comes to Dread in particular, I would write the script and I'd go back over it and take out nearly everything he says. And not necessarily give the dialogue to other characters, but the less he says, the better. Because he doesn't answer to anybody. He doesn't have to tell anybody anything. They can find their own way. So occasionally I've seen stories by other writers where Dredd has a nice big chunky piece of dialogue and I'm going, No. There's no way he'd stick around long enough to say all this.
Yeah.
But that's just my personal taste. What I particularly love is when I'm imagining a script from a novice writer who grew up learning to write scripts by reading Alan Moore scripts. Okay. And you go, oh, here comes a page and a half of description for one panel. That's great. Oh, there's 12 panels on this page. Oh, great. brevity is very important. You have to learn the John Wagner way, where he would basically say, panel one, or page two, panel one, Dread, close up. And you go, that's all you have to go with. So, we need a happy medium. And I don't mean Doris Stokes on ecstasy,
And you've only both mentioned that this is something that an experiment that you would like to repeat in the future. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference? Because when I say that 2008 has dipped its toe in the waters with crossovers, of course there was Trifecta, which was the first example of a gang of writers actually getting together to work that out. Is it a law of diminishing returns? Is there a risk that such things can lose the potency of the idea? Or if you were to do it again, would you do it with fewer characters? Would you do it in a different way, bring in different universes, or keep it in Dreadworld?
Yeah, well, Trifecta was a very specific theme because the guys worked on that brilliantly and had a very specific goal, but also had three separate ongoing stories. I actually still regret to this day that Al Ewing told me what was coming up before I read it in the prog, because I would have loved that. But in this case, we knew we had limited stories, as in the other stories were about 6 pages each, and that was it. And there was no immediate follow on. I think, because the Dreadworld stories have always had kind of a twitch of crossover, like every now and again, Coburn shows up, this kind of thing. This one didn't come as a great surprise to anybody. We were at the very beginning, Maura, we did have the idea that we wouldn't tell anybody what we were doing. People would assume they were separate stories. And then when they got to the end, they go, hang on a minute, this is the same guy he was in that one, that kind of thing. But that didn't prove to be workable. I don't think there's a diminishing returns problem, because everybody knows that the Dreadworld is linked, all the stories, that's why it's called that, they're all connected. I think if we suddenly brought in characters from something else, that was unexpected. I mean, if we did bring in a kingdom or I don't know, something else, like Proteus Vex. Oh, why did I think of that one? That would be a surprise, and the readers wouldn't see that coming. But then, you know, that would be kind of cheating. We wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, it depends on if you did it in a Meg or in a Prague, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, the structure of the story, how it's being told, and the medium in which it's being told will affect the... I know this sounds really boring, you know, but those permutations are the very first things you think about, like... how they interact with each other. Like if you were going to have, a series of Megs with the same set of stories interlinked, or one following another over a series, or doing them in the progs, all of that's going to affect how you do it. The other thing is, if you're working with other writers, you do have to have a meeting of minds, as in everyone has to be okay to work together and to not be trying to out jostle the other. And I don't think generally that would be a problem, but that is something, you know, everyone has to be on the same goal, which is that the story, the interlinked storylines will all work to a great conclusion. Yeah. You probably need someone steering the ship, because in some fashion, it doesn't have to be like a dictator, but because you do have to have, if you're going to do interlinked stories that with an overall satisfying narrative, you need a beginning and an end. You can do stuff in the middle, but you do need those two things. And you do need agreement of all the writers to do those two things. Because if someone goes off piste in the middle, that is the domino effect for everyone else is going to be horrendous. So, you know what I mean? It's not, the spontaneity is actually quite difficult, to do in the 2000 AD universe. But then deciding who you want to, what characters you want to use. I mean, the sky's the limit. You can do so much. There's so many great characters out there. You could pull in. There's so much potential, but it is a lot of extra work. And most of the writers will, you know, we are jobbing writers. We're given X amount of issues, and then we do that job and then we move on and do other things, you know? So there's a lot of constraints there.
Yeah. I think, what Maura says, yeah, there's a huge amount of scope that you could do with the crossover thing, because I did a quick calculation there recently. I think there's like 150 different Dreadworld series have happened. Some of them are very limited, like they're one-offs or here and there, but there's a huge amount. But it's been 40 odd years, and two publications plus all the annuals and specials and poster progs and things like that. And we've never done Fuzzy Felt, but by God, we're getting there. So there's a huge area. Basically, this is a sand pit with a lot of sand, and most of it is irradiated, and there are scorpions. But picking the right characters was really, I wouldn't necessarily pick the characters that we picked if it had it been up to me. Again, that comes back to the fact that if I'd had a completely free hand, and if, for example, if I was doing this alone without Mora, I would have chosen very different characters, and it wouldn't have been as good. But because Matt basically said we want Inaba, we want Chopper, we want Armitage and Devon Waugh, we knew that Anderson and Dredd were a given. Anderson, well, Dredd because it's Dredd. Anderson was a given because of the nature of the story, and those restrictions are basically the framework, if you like, for the story. If we had a completely free hand, I would have. There's other, I don't want to spoil it, but there are other characters I was really keen to bring in. But they would have been the wrong characters. So some of them in particular.
Well, again, it's a kind of, chicken and egg scenario. Like once you know who you're using, everything adapts to that, you know? So, you know, we knew at the start the characters and then we adapted to that. So... So this is again comes back to the weird alchemy of creating these things, but comics are, as I've said many times, comics are very structured, really technical things to write, and there's a lot of things you have to think about when you're creating them, when you're writing them, and then you have to leave space for your artists to come in and do their amazing work, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, one thing that we always have to be aware of is that if we don't give the artists and the other, actually the visual creators, if you like, the artists, colors, letters, the right kind of freedom that and the ability to be flexible, then we're constraining them. And truly, the whole point of a visual medium is to emphasize the visuals. It isn't solely about the visuals, but they are telling the story. We can't, if we do anything that kind of messes with that, that's a bad thing, you know. Our job is to curate them in a sense. So we work for the artists and the letterers and the colorists. Hang on a second. But no, it's true though.
Lovely. Great. I mean, we've done an hour, so...
Great stuff.
What else are you working on, lads?
Well, let's go through that little formality then. I mean, you've both already mentioned that you're working on more 2000 AD stuff, Mora. I think you said you're working on a new Anderson.
Yeah, it will pull on a thread from this story, you know, and... yeah, I'm literally on that this week. That's one of my jobs this week, is to get that done, and off to the artist. And that will be in the autumn, Meg, I believe.
Cool. I've got, we're working on a two-part Dread at the moment, just nailing the story specifics down. And hopefully I'll get that written by the end of the week. Beyond that, though, we've got a new series of Proteus X coming up. And just last night, the art for the first episode came in. And it was like, there's Jake Lynch on top form again. So that's Proteus X book 3 coming soon. And Dreadnoughts book 2 hopefully will be coming soon at some point. We'll see. What else have we got?
You've got the novellas.
Novellas. Hang on. Hooray! Judge is Necessary Evil. And coming very, very soon, What Measures Ye Meet by, look, C.E. Murphy, who is one of my favourite living writers after me and Mora. there's a fair bit coming up, so it's pretty good. We don't know yet whether or not we'll be getting an autumn special or a winter special or a late spring special or anything like that on the heels of this one. But I imagine this new special will probably sell 400,000 copies each. at least, yeah, and they make a movie of it and everything like that.
Well, you know, if we didn't get to do this again, it was nice to do it once. That's the way I look at it, you know.
Yeah, and if we didn't get to do it again, we can bask in the knowledge that we poisoned it for everybody else.
On that note.
That's certainly one way to look at it, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah, on that note.
That was actually a hint about the story, so sorry.
Oh, no, true, actually. You're so clever, Mike.
Thank you very much indeed to Maura and to Mike for that. If you want a copy of the 2000 AD Sci-Fi special, then either go along to your local newsagent or comic book store, where it should be stocked. If you can't get hold of a copy, there's always 2000AD.com or the 2000AD app, which is available for Apple and Android devices. As I said at the beginning, we'll be back in 7 days' time when we're going to be hearing our interview from a few years ago with film director Ben Wheatley. Seems like a perfect opportunity because his new film, In the Woods, is coming out. It'll be great to hear that again. As always, if you want to give any feedback or any suggestions, philcast@2080.com. We'll see you in a week's time, athletes. Until then, stay safe. And Splendid Verthrick.
Alert! 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 Fill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.